Just as important as what the periodic reporting rules will do is what they will not do. This reporting is not intended to provide the public with insight into the quality of a firm's audit practice or to present a snapshot of the firm's financial condition. While the rules will provide some data regarding litigation, that information is not designed as an early warning system regarding possible firm instability or catastrophic loss. Whether, and if so how, the board should use its authority to create that broader kind of reporting is the subject of much current debate. In 2007, the Department of the Treasury established a federal advisory committee to examine the auditing profession. Last week, the advisory committee issued a paper which raises questions regarding whether the board should require larger auditing firms to disclose information to the public related to audit quality, financial condition, and stability. Those ideas are now open for public comment and will presumably be addressed in the advisory committee's final report later this year. Notwithstanding the ongoing advisory committee work, there are good reasons to adopt the more modest rules now. The majority of registered U.S. firms submitted their registration applications in 2003, and the majority of non-U.S. firms submitted their applications in 2004. Therefore, the data in most registration applications is between 4 and 5 years old. The board's work, particularly planning inspections, will benefit from a reporting system that regularly and automatically refreshes this information rather than forcing the board's staff to collect updates ad hoc. It's also important to recognize that periodic reporting, regardless of the specific information covered, requires the board to build new infrastructure, particularly IT infrastructure. Creating a web-based filing system that can be integrated with other board functions has entailed some challenges. Once that system is in place, however, it will be relatively easy to expand it to encompass new kinds of information if the board decides that's appropriate. But the first step is to get periodic reporting up and running. Careful consideration has gone into what should, and equally important, what should not be included in these rules. As a practical matter, most registered firms are not routinely involved in litigation, in mergers, in associations with barred auditors, or most of the other kinds of events that these rules address. For smaller firms with limited resources to devote to regulatory filings, and that certainly describes the great majority of the 1,900 registered firms, reporting should not turn out to be a major burden. Of course, just wading through and understanding the 90 or so pages of explanatory release, rule text, and form instructions will in itself be a daunting task. I hope we will be producing a plain English or a practical guide to periodic reporting to help small firms comply. I can also certainly assure the smaller firms that we'll make it a priority to provide practical guidance and advice on periodic reporting at the firm's small business forums. Finally, I'd just like to join you, Mr. Chairman, in thanking everyone who's been involved in this long-running project and putting these recommendations together, in particular Michael Stevenson, Sarah Williams, and Patty Thompson for their thoughtful work. Michael, in particular, has been both tireless and infinitely patient, dealing with ideas, comments, and, at least on my part, numerous small edits. So, thank you. Let me ask just a couple of things that maybe bring out some additional points beyond those that you touched on in your presentation. First, I guess we've both said now that for most firms, or certainly at least most small firms, filing a Form 3, that is, so not the annual report, but the special report, should be a quite rare event. Do you have any sense of what the Form 3 reporting requirement will mean for the largest firms? And how often do you think the Big Four, or the Big Eight, or the 10 or 11 firms with 100 or over 100 public company audit clients will have to deal with Form 3 reporting?
I think the short answer is, We don't know for sure until we see. But I don't think there's any particular reason to think that that this will be a significant ongoing recurring burden even for those firms. But the answer, you know, lies in things about that I don't know. I don't think we know about how frequently they might be hiring people who are subject to certain disciplinary sanctions in their past or Commission 102E orders. There's an element of that that we just don't know. But I think that the reporting triggers in Form 3. We've tried to be careful and keep them to what we think would be useful and necessary, and with an eye on not creating big burdens and getting information that we wouldn't necessarily have any use for. But I think the answer to your questions, we'll just have to see.
Well, I guess it would be interesting to find out. I mean, as you're suggesting, probably the thing that would be most likely to trigger a Form 3, or most commonly trigger a Form 3, would be association with someone with some sort of a disciplinary history, and I would assume that that's a relatively rare event for the large firms, but I think it'll be worthwhile to find out. I think you alluded in your comments, Michael, to the fact that the forms have to be accurate and that there could be board discipline for inaccurate filings. That's part of the reason we have the amendment rule, so that people can make corrections if there are errors in previous Form 2 or Form 3 filings. Do these rules contain a standard of care? As well? What's the standard by which responsibility for an inaccurate filing would be judged? I mean, I'm thinking, for example, perhaps of a situation where, to continue with the example we're talking about, let's say a person associated with a firm and misled the firm about whether he or she had a disciplinary history, and as a result, the firm didn't accurately make a filing reflecting that fact.
The rules don't create or articulate a standard of care. I mean, the rules require reports to be filed timely and reports to be accurate and complete. Failure to do that would be a violation of the rules. I think the important question then which statutory sanctions the board could impose would depend on the state of mind factors. I mean, in the statute, there are two tiers of sanctions, and the more severe sanctions require that the violation be knowing or reckless or involve repeated instances of negligent conduct. Other sanctions are available for any other violations that fall short of that threshold. And I think second, the issue of discretion comes into play in a situation you're describing where we believe that the firm has done everything it reasonably could and was misled by someone else, and as a result, its form was inaccurate. I think that's a situation where the board would bring some discretion to bear in considering whether that was an appropriate case to impose any sanctions.
Okay, that's helpful. Let me turn to something else. You outlined some of the changes between the proposal and the final rules. Let me ask you about two things that I believe you didn't mention that were in the proposal but have changed or disappeared from the final version. As proposed, Form 3 would have required a firm to report to us if they associated with an individual who had been at another firm when it was sanctioned, although the individual was not himself or herself sanctioned. I believe I have that correct, but that's...
Form 2.
Form 2, the annual report. But that's disappeared from the final version of the rules. Why?
You're right, that's disappeared. We received a lot of comment on that one. Expressing concern, essentially fairness concerns, that we were setting up a situation where an individual who had been at a firm at the time of conduct for which the firm was sanctioned, as that person tried to move to a different firm, would create a reporting, that alone would create a reporting obligation for the new firm. And commenters expressed some concerns about, you know, whether that was necessary, whether that was fair, whether that would diminish professional opportunities for people who happen to be in that situation, even though, you know, they may have had nothing to do with whatever the firm was disciplined for. We carefully considered all of that and came to the view that any occasional value that that information might have is outweighed by the fact that treating that information as a risk indicator, either about the individual or the firm that they're going to, would have the potential to diminish some professional opportunities for people who potentially had no connection to the misconduct, or even who may have had an alleged connection to the misconduct, but never had an opportunity to defend against charges because of a situation where the regulator was content to settle a matter with the firm and not pursue the individual. And so it's for that, those kinds of reasons that we have, we're not recommending that the board include that item.
I think it's the right decision. I mean, I guess if you think of an Arthur Anderson type situation, you'd have potentially hundreds and hundreds of people leaving a firm that had been indicted or convicted and then triggering a reporting obligation at their new firm, even though they had nothing at all to do with the, you know, the misconduct at the prior firm. On the other hand, I suppose there is some risk of people sort of below the radar causing trouble at a firm and then moving to a new firm, even though they themselves managed to escape the sanctions. But you know, if you try to cover everything in rules, every possibility in rules like this, you end up with a pretty complex and burdensome structure. Something else that has changed: the proposal would have required a filing by the audit firm if it withdrew an audit opinion, but the company failed to file the required 8K to reflect that fact. And it also would have required a filing with us by the firm if a client, an issuer, had used the firm's name improperly, that is, filed an unauthorized audit opinion, something surprisingly we do see from time to time. As I understand it now, in the final version of the rules, we've kept the first element, that is, auditor has to report if company doesn't file 10K, but we've deleted the second element. What's the reasoning behind that?
That's exactly right, and the reasoning is we received on those two items, we received a lot of comments. A lot of commenters addressed those two items and addressed them in essentially the same terms. That is to say, they perceived both of those items as instances of the board reporting the firm or requiring the firm to report information about something the issuer has done that is potentially problematic about the issuer. And commenters expressed the view that that's maybe not the right sphere for board reporting requirements on firms, that those kinds of things are best left to the SEC and its disclosure framework and its framework for dealing with reports from firms under Section 10-CAFA of the Exchange Act. We considered that pretty carefully, and I think that we agree with that reason. We think that's right with respect to the issue of reporting that an issuer has, without authorization, used the auditor's name in a filing with the SEC. That is not, on its face, necessarily any indication of anything about the auditor's conduct. It's solely about the issuer. And for that kind of reasoning, we're not today recommending that the board include that item. We view the reporting of withdrawn audit reports differently, though. A withdrawn audit report is a risk indicator concerning the auditor's conduct preceding withdrawal, not merely a risk indicator concerning the issuer's financial statements. The board has a regulatory interest in being aware of that information, possibly following up on that information, for reasons directly related to its oversight of auditors. So we think it's appropriate that the board require firms to report when they've withdrawn an audit report. Now, at the same time, there's no reason to ignore the fact that in most cases, the issuer will separately have reported that to the commission. And when the issuer has done so, there's no need for the firm separately to report that to us because we'll be aware of it. So the Form 3 obligation is structured in a way, such a way as to excuse the firm from the filing obligation so long as the issuer has disclosed the information in 8K. I think that's the right way to understand that Form 3 requirement rather than to understand it as a requirement that the firm, in effect, report that it has some concern about the issuer's financial statements or that the firm report that the issuer has failed to comply with a commission filing requirement.
Well, okay. I mean, to me, at least, I guess the philosophical distinction between the two is maybe a little elusive, but perhaps it's worth adding that in the case of a client filing an unauthorized audit report, that would be a fairly serious matter. It would certainly be illegal in itself, and the auditor couldn't just sit by quietly when that happened. They would have obligations under Section 10A of the Act. In fact, we even have an enforcement case on that.
That's right.
Just two other things. I mean, you touched on something that does concern me, and that is the ability of small firms to understand what's in these rules and comply. I think you all have done a fantastic job on these materials we're considering today, but I wouldn't recommend them as bedtime reading to anyone.
Unless you're trying to
get them. I guess that's right. What can we do to help smaller firms understand what's involved here? Because I think for most small firms, once they make their way through the requirements, they'll see that, well, not that there's less than meets the eye, but that it shouldn't be a massive burden for most small firms.
I think that's right, and I'm sure we anticipate, and I know Sarah and her team are bracing for the first round of reporting. We anticipate firms will have questions and we want to make sure that they're doing things right. I'm optimistic that once they get familiar with the system and once they understand what's required of them, they'll understand it as a fairly straightforward, not overly burdensome responsibility. But you're right that the release that we're recommending the board issue today is not a practical guide to how to understand the system or how to comply with the requirements, and we think something like that is important to prepare before or by the time the rules take effect and before firms start to try to comply, and we plan to do that.
Well, again, I do think that's important, and because we don't know exactly how fast the SEC will act on these rules, and the annual reporting deadline would still be a year away, but firms may have at least to consider what their Form 3 obligations are within the next, conceivably 4 or 5 months, so it's something we need to work on. Just last, and you made some intriguing, to me at least, references to the fee that will be associated with this reporting. I don't think you're getting any more guidance about what the staff intends to recommend in that area. I mean, maybe a beginning question is, will those fees be a subject of rulemaking and public comment?
We haven't approached the fee issue as if it would be a subject of rulemaking and public comment. It was not done that way in the registration context. There's nothing in the Act that requires the board to do it by rule, and I think it's not unusual to have fees set outside of a rulemaking context. So that's not currently what we're thinking of recommending. Of course, ultimately, that's up to the board, but that's not currently what we're thinking of recommending.
Well, you mentioned the registration fees. Those are, I guess you'd say, steeply progressive. In other words, the large firms have to pay much larger fees than a small firm would. Do you envision that the fee structure would be the same, have that same progressivity to it here?
I think that's an important and complex issue that we're still trying to work through. I mean, as you can imagine, nobody wants to wind up with an annual fee that is so high that a lot of firms don't want to be registered because of the fee. At the same time, you don't want to tier the fee structure in a way that firms are afraid to grow their practice by one more client because it's going to be steeply more expensive. So there are a lot of things to balance, and we're working through that.
Well, I don't know the answer either, but I would just reiterate what you said, and I hope we can comply with our obligation to recover the costs of running this system, which is what I think the Act requires of us, without setting the fees in a way that they are themselves going to be any factor in firms' decisions as to whether to engage in public company auditing. Thank you very much.
Charlie.
I also support the adoption of these rules today. They represent a modest beginning, but an important step to developing a system of reporting that facilitates the PCAOB's oversight. The rules before us today primarily serve a regulatory function, and that they will provide the PCAOB with information useful in planning inspections and performing other oversight responsibilities. At the same time, they provide a platform for other sorts of reporting and disclosure requirements that we may consider in the future. I mention this because recently a public dialogue has begun about information regarding audit firms that may be necessary or appropriate for investors to have. As mentioned earlier by my colleagues, the U.S. Treasury's Advisory Committee on the Auditing Profession has engaged in considerable discussion on this topic. This is an important topic that deserves consideration, which I hope would result in the PCAOB issuing a concept release or other paper on how the rules being considered today might be built upon. There is one aspect of today's rules that I'd like to highlight as new information that benefits both our regulatory work and investor needs. First, under these rules, for the first time, auditors will have a vehicle to report publicly withdrawals of audit reports when issuers have failed to report the fact of their withdrawal in the 8K filing with the SEC. Not only will investors benefit from having notice of withdrawals of audit reports when an issuer doesn't comply with the requirement to disclose a withdrawal, but it also provides the PCAOB with important information for our own assessment of risk of an audit failure. Finally, I'd also like to join in thanking the staff who worked on this project, Patty, Sarah, and Michael. While it's an important part of our regulatory framework, setting up rules to establish a filing system can be and probably was at times quite tedious. Michael, and particularly, tirelessly refined the proposal to spot potential loopholes as well as opportunities to make the requirements as easy as possible. Speaking selfishly, at times I've wondered whether it's a good idea to put one of our best minds on a project. But Michael, you've handled it without any appearance of difficulty, and I'd like to thank you. And as you know, I have the utmost respect and gratitude for you and your work.
Thank you.
Bill, here. Steve. Well, thank you, Chairman Olson, and first let me take this opportunity to thank you, the other members of the board, Mr. Gelter, Niemeyer, and Gratison, for the warm welcome I received since my appointment last week. I very much appreciate it. I would also like to take this opportunity to say that I'm greatly honored by the confidence shown in me by SEC Chairman Cox, Commissioner Kathy Casey, whose leadership and public service I know well from our work together in the U.S. Senate, and Commissioner Atkins. And I also want to express my gratitude to Chairman Bernanke of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System and Treasury Secretary Paulson. The seat I take was held since the board's inception by Kayla Gillen, and her contributions to the founding and establishment of the PCAOB are well recognized. Her work helped shape the organization around its essential mission as set out in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, namely to, quote, protect the interest of investors, close quote. With that mission in mind, it seems fitting that my first open board meeting is to consider rules designed to enhance transparency in the auditing profession. Clear, concise, and timely communication of relevant information is vital to protecting investors and shareholders alike, and I support the rules the board is considering this morning. Adopting these rules today may be only a starting point, as other members have mentioned, for improved transparency, a basis for other possible reporting requirements as we consider the recommendations currently being developed by the Treasury's Advisory Committee on the Auditing Profession. One of the many reasons I'm delighted to be on the board is to see whether I can help contribute to making audit reports of public companies more investor-friendly.
Finally, let me say how much I look forward to working with the staff of the PCOB, including standard setters, investigators, inspectors, and enforcers around the country. When I first arrived, you, Chairman Olson, told me what an outstanding organization I was about to join. The professionalism of the staff of the PCOB is well-established and well-known, and I consider myself truly fortunate to be included in such a group. I look forward to working with you in the future. And finally, I want to associate myself with the comments of Mr. Gelser in terms of the need to be particularly sensitive to the plight of small firms and the recording requirements to small firms, the need for plain English practical guidance. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Steve, and welcome again, and thanks to Michael and Sarah. Jerry got off easy this morning, but I think all of us know that that the burden's going to start falling to you as soon as we start implementing, so get ready. We know we're going to hear a lot more from you.
Yeah.
There's no further discussion. I'll put the question to the board. All those in favor of approving the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The ayes have it, and the motion is carried. There's no further business. This concludes our agenda today. The meeting is now adjourned. We will rise from our open meeting and reconvene in the closed meeting in 10 minutes.